This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headley in Maryland. Protesters filled streets, parks, and public spaces in every state, nationwide this week. They're protesting police brutality after a Minneapolis police officer killed George Floyd last week. Most were peaceful, some turned violent. Tens of thousands turned out in Floyd's hometown of Houston, while thousands of others chanted his name in historic Lafayette Square behind the White House. But here's what his six-year-old daughter Gianna said about him in a viral video posted to Instagram by Floyd's longtime friend, Stephen Jackson.
Daddy changed the world!
Daddy changed the world!
Whether or not she's right depends on how the rest of us react to her father's death. She will likely carry this grief for the rest of her life, and no child should have to cope with losing her dad to police brutality. But she's one of thousands of people who carry that grief because a loved one has been killed by a police officer. Here to talk about this and other top national stories this week, we have Eugene Scott, a political reporter with The Washington Post. Eugene, welcome back to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Anita Kumar is White House correspondent and associate editor with Politico. Anita, good to have you.
Thanks for having me back.
And Daniel Neuhauser is a freelance journalist, former senior political reporter at Vice News. Daniel, it's good to have you as well.
Thanks for having me back.
So, understandably, the protests have dominated the American conversation this week. Tens of thousands have marched for 10 straight nights in protests, often defying curfews, sometimes clashing with law enforcement. I wonder, what do you see, Eugene? Are some overall themes or trends beginning to emerge from you for you?
Yes, I think one of the most fascinating things about this period is just how different the demonstrators are demographically than past protests, especially 5 years ago when we think about the killing of Mike Brown in Ferguson. This current group, it's so much more diverse racially and generationally. I think when you look at some of the photos and videos in Minneapolis and across the country, I mean, you know, we're seeing protests in Alaska and South Dakota. It's not just inner city Black Americans who are young and having, you know, negative encounters with law enforcement that are in the streets. And I think that is in part due to what video and social media has allowed in this moment. It really has exposed this issue to new eyes and made people get involved and interested who previously were not.
Daniel, is there also a kind of a overriding mood to the protests? I mean, it's understandable that many cable news channels will feature the passionate or violent moments, but what do we see that's in common among most protests?
Yeah, I think if you compare these protests to other protests over the last couple of years, say Occupy DC or Disrupt J20, you know, when I was out there over this past weekend and watching them remotely throughout the course of the week, there is a different nature to these protests. It seems there is a resolve and a fire that we hadn't seen, but also, I mean, the protests are got out of hand midweek, and the sort of the looting and the violence and the pushback from the police has also been, you know, of a nature that we hadn't seen over the last couple of years. Definitely an intensity to these protests that stands out when compared to other similar protests.
And Anita, we have heard that there have been a number of not just attacks, journalists injured, but some journalists are saying they have been targeted because they're holding a camera. What do we know about the relationship in these protests between the journalists covering them and law enforcement?
Well, you're exactly right. We're seeing, you know, stories pop up all over the country, really. It's not one city or one time, but we're seeing, you know, probably these aren't that many people compared to all the people and the journalists that are out there covering these and the protests that are out there. But we are seeing them. And I think one of the reasons it's resonating this time around is because of social media, is because of these little video snippets that you can see of journalists being targeted. They've been targeted, you know, they are essential workers and they can stay after curfews. But in lots of places, you know, you saw the New York City officials talk about this, you know, in the last day or so, that journalists can be out, they can be covering this. But instead, we're seeing journalists arrested, journalists pushed, journalists told to get out of the way. And it's really, I think, resonating with a lot of people because we are the eyes and ears of people on these streets, and they want to see what is going on. And you've seen city officials push back on this, but still we keep seeing these incidents come forward.
It's incredible to think that George Floyd was killed just last Monday. Last week, Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was charged with murder. He knelt on George Floyd's neck for more than 8 minutes. But protesters have promised to march until charges are brought against all four police officers involved in his death. And when asked on Sunday what he thought should happen, Police Chief Madeira Arredondo said all four officers are responsible in his idea.
Being silent or not intervening, to me, you're complicit. So I don't see a level of distinction any different. Obviously, the charging and those decisions will have to come through our county attorney's office. Certainly the FBI is investigating that. But to the Floyd family, I want you to know that my decision to fire all four officers was not based on some sort of hierarchy. Mr. Floyd died in our hands.
Wednesday, the other three officers were also charged and arrested. Daniel, where does this case stand at the moment?
Well, it's really interesting that Derek Chauvin at first was charged with a third-degree murder, which would basically just requires the state to prove reckless disregard. But those charges were upped the other day to second-degree murder. Now, there's a distinction here. This would not require the state to prove intent. Because what they are trying to say is that there was not necessarily intent to kill, but it's second-degree murder during the commission of a different felony, which is third-degree assault. The difference here, of course, is that Chauvin can now be charged with up to 40 years in prison, and that would have been different. It would have been up to 25 before. And, of course, everybody else, the other officers, are going to be charged with aiding and abetting.
Eugene, there's still skepticism, though, because even when police officers have been charged in the past, it rarely ends up in a conviction. Do we have any indication this might end differently than the cases we've seen in the past?
Well, to your point, we can't be certain, but I think when Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison was explaining why he was changing the charges, he implied that he was hoping to choose a charge that could be more likely to be proven and perhaps therefore lead to a conviction, which is a real concern for many activists and just Black Americans, period, who year after year have seen police officers get off, despite even video evidence suggesting that they were involved in the death of an individual that should have led to something serious.
In Louisville, no one has been charged in the death of Breonna Taylor. Earlier this year, police executed a no-knock warrant and killed her in the middle of the night. This is her birthday. She would have been 27 today. And amid the protests and civil unrest in Louisville, law enforcement shot and killed a Black man there named David McCatty, who owned a little barbecue stand. Anita, what are we seeing in terms of responses by law enforcement around the country to various cases?
Well, I mean, in that Louisville case, you're seeing, well, two of these cases, you know, sort of back to back over these last couple months. You saw the police chief in Louisville fired, immediately after this. Even if the charges aren't coming, even if we don't know exactly how some of these trials are going to end, the fact that the police chief was fired really, you know, sort of shows that. I think local officials, state officials, federal officials, they're all really feeling the pressure here. They can look around the country and actually the world. That's the thing that has really struck me is these massive protests outside the United States in the name of George Floyd. They can look around the world and see that this is, you know, they don't know how this is going to end, but they see that the pressure is on now. They see this movement happening now, and they see that they're going to be held accountable for that. So, you know, the police chief getting fired is just one sign of that, and perhaps we'll see more coming, you know, more actions coming over these next weeks and months.
We got one tweet from Kelly who says, if someone wants to do violence to black men, women, and children, they have to come through me first, an old white grandmother of three. Find me at the protests. And Daisy tweets, please talk about the militarization of police. They should be trained as peacekeepers, not an occupying force. Never fear, Daisy, we are going to talk about that in just a moment. We're speaking with Eugene Scott with The Washington Post, Anita Kumar with Politico, and Daniel Neuhauser is a freelance journalist, formerly with Vice News. Family, friends, and public officials convened in Minneapolis on Thursday to honor the life of George Floyd. Many gave impassioned speeches and remembrances, including the Reverend Al Sharpton and Floyd's family lawyer, Ben Crump.
When we fight for the least of these, what we are really doing is helping America live up to its creed. What we're really doing is helping America be the great beacon of hope and justice for all the world to marvel. But most importantly, brothers and sisters, what we are doing is helping America be America for all Americans.
The first of several memorial services for Floyd. He will be buried in Houston on Tuesday. I'm Celeste Headlee. You're listening to 1A from WMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Lightstream. Refinance your high-interest credit cards with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Rates start at 5.95% APR with autopay and excellent credit. For a special discount, apply at lightstream.com/1A. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.5% autopay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/1A for more information.
The more Hasan Minhaj learns about his faith and spirituality, the more questions he has. So he turned to his father for answers.
He said, don't worry about the number of questions. Just worry about which questions become more clear and solidified.
Comedian Hasan Minhaj on Keeping the Faith.
Listen now to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking about the week's top headlines with Eugene Scott with The Washington Post, Anita Kumar with Politico, and Daniel Neuhauser, a freelance journalist formerly with Vice News. And you, of course. You can comment on our Facebook page. Tell us your thoughts at the end of this extraordinary week. You can tweet us at 1A or email us as well. Let's get updated on one other case that we have been following, and that's the February killing of Ahmaud Arbery, a black jogger in Georgia. A father and son pair were arrested last week and charged with murder. Daniel, there's a preliminary court hearing this week. What did we learn?
Well, we did learn that very unfortunately, after Ahmaud Arbery was shot, he had also before being shot been hit by a truck, but also his killer allegedly used a racial slur against him, something that will certainly reinforce the prosecution's case that this was a hate crime.
Let's talk about the president's response. The president addressed the nation from the White House Rose Garden on Monday evening. That's the first time he's spoken to the populace since the protests began. Following that talk, Attorney General Bill Barr ordered law enforcement to forcibly kill clear protesters from outside the White House so that Trump could pose for a photo at St. John's Church across Lafayette Square. This got an immediate reaction from a number of faith leaders and Democratic politicians. They've denounced that move. And among the faith leaders, Bishop Marion Budde, who oversees St. John's Church.
The president just used a Bible, the most sacred text of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and one of the churches of my diocese, without permission, as a backdrop for a message antithetical to the teachings of Jesus and everything that our churches stand for. And to do so, as you just said, he sanctioned the use of tear gas by police officers in riot gear to clear the churchyard. I am outraged.
Eugene, have we heard similar condemnation from other faith leaders or conservative faith leaders, I should say?
We have not. And in fact, we have heard praise from individuals like Franklin Graham and Robert Jeffries. And Trump went ahead to point that out and make it known that the voters from faith traditions that support him most appreciated his photo op at St. John's Church, along with his photo op at the shrine for John Paul II. And that very much, I believe, was a part of what that move from the president was aimed to do, to really let those who are concerned broadly about what is happening in the country's cities know that Trump actually is a moral leader and has the ability to guide America through this process. But people outside of those tribes of faith who back Trump aren't as convinced.
There is a lot of reaction, though, to that particular photo op at St. John's. Anita, there are also questions about whether the action taken to forcibly clear peaceful protesters was legal. And we have received a number of questions about whether or not it was actually tear gas that was used to disperse protesters. I wonder if you could clarify what we know about what was used to clear those people.
That is a great question, and I think one that's still out there. The Trump team, and I say that because it's really his re-election campaign, has been pushing very hard that it was not tear gas, that is, as they say, fake news, and that it's been reported wrong. My colleague was there. Other journalists were there. They say some kind of chemical was used to induce tears, whether that is officially tear gas as we know it or some other chemical. Is a little bit unclear. The Park Service says it was not tear gas. You have some law enforcement saying it's not, but then there was something used, and I believe a local news outlet also found canisters. So it's really unclear. You've seen some fact checks saying, though, that something was used that is like tear gas, if it's not exactly tear gas. I mean, I think really the bigger point here is that this was what everybody who was around there calls a peaceful protest, and they were forcibly removed in a variety of ways with a variety of different, you know, methods used. And whether that was the right thing to do and, you know, for the president. Now, I will say the Attorney General, Bill Barr, has said it wasn't so the president could walk across the street. It was supposed to be done earlier that day because he thought there needed to be another block, you know, more of a perimeter around the White House. It wasn't done. And so he went and got it done. It happened to be, he says, coincidentally, right before the president wanted to walk across
very
the street.
Suspicious timing.
And, you know, the president couldn't have been able to walk across the street if that was not cleared. This, you know, for security reasons, there were too many people around. You know, the last time he went to St. John's Church, it's not often. He went a year ago in 2019. He drove there, and that's actually pretty typical for a motorcade to go, even that small route. So, you know, it does seem that he wanted to do that. He wanted to walk there. He wanted that photo op, as you said, and the timing is suspect.
Yeah, it is. And we have seen a little bit of internal pushback over that decision to remove peaceful protesters by force. James Miller of the Defense Advisory Board resigned his position. Daniel, were there others among the Trump administration that we know have questioned that decision?
Well, Defense Secretary Esper at first seemed sort of out of line with the president, and he is in a way. He says he doesn't support using the Insurrection Act, an old act that would allow Trump to send active duty military to respond to protests. And there are 1,600 troops at bases around D.C. who've been called up from the southern parts of the U.S. standing ready. If Trump does say he wants to, as he says he wants to, if he actually pulls, decides to activate them. And at first, Secretary Esper said he was going to send them home, but it seems now he's reconsidered that. Now, there are people, former people in the administration, as I'm sure we'll talk about, Jim Mattis, among the most prominent of them.
Let me just interrupt you for just one moment, Daniel, so we can hear a little bit from Esper. And we're talking about the current Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, who did, in fact, order troops out of the nation's capital twice this week and says he does not support the president's push to use the Insurrection Act to suppress protests.
The option to use active duty forces in a law enforcement role should only be used as a matter of last resort, and only in the most urgent and dire of situations. We are not in one of those situations now. I do not support invoking the Insurrection Act.
Eugene, generally, we have seen in the past that when a member of the Trump administration goes against the president, it is often not very long before they leave the Trump administration. Are we hearing about reaction among the inner circle to Esper's contradiction of the president?
Yes, there have been some rumors so far that the president is eyeing other options and that Esper actually is on thin ice. And I believe White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany, when asked about this earlier this week, said that as of now, Esper is still the defense secretary. And I think there was a lot of emphasis from listeners and viewers on the temporary nature as of now. Regardless of whether or not his point is fair or accurate, we know that the president is very sensitive right now and very anxious and not that open to criticism from inside his ranks about how he is handling this very difficult moment that most people think he is mishandling.
Well, then the former Secretary of Defense under Trump was James Mattis. He's known for not being outspoken. And yet he wrote a barn burner of an op-ed in the Atlantic this week that, quote, Donald Trump is the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unite the American people, does not even pretend to try. Instead, he tries to divide us, end quote. Anita, that wasn't even the only strongly worded phrase in that op-ed. How big a deal is this to hear this from James Mattis?
It's a really big deal. And the reason is because so many people in Washington have trusted him for so long. You know, he was the first defense secretary. And when he came aboard right at the beginning of the administration, there were a lot of people, Republicans included, who said, you know, I feel better knowing that he's there. You know, they maybe didn't trust President Trump, didn't really know what to expect at that point. You know, that's the beginning of the administration, but felt really good that he was there sort of to provide a check. He's a military man, esteemed, has this long record. And so it is a big deal. What you saw is people on Capitol Hill, members of Congress saying, you know, some of them anyway, saying, look at this person. This person that I've trusted for so long is saying this, and I really need to look at that. You know, you saw with a couple Republican senators, Mitt Romney and also Lisa Murkowski of Alaska saying, that really meant something to her. She broke with the president on this because she felt that if General Mattis had come out and talked, she could too. Now the president has gone after her, so yeah, it's a little bit unclear whether other people will do the same, other Republicans. But you really saw around town in this circle of Washington folks, people saying if General Mattis said that, maybe it really is true.
We also heard from Army General Mark Milley, who's also chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, reminding leaders of the armed forces to remain true to the Constitution and the American people in what was really a remarkable statement. And we heard another familiar voice this week. President Barack Obama held a town hall via Zoom on Wednesday. He spoke directly to America's young people of color and gave his support for peaceful demonstrations.
Every step of progress in this country, every expansion of freedom, every expression of our deepest ideals has been won through efforts that made the status quo uncomfortable.
Eugene, why are we hearing from Barack Obama right now?
Well, I think the former president made it very clear during his endorsement of Joe Biden, his former vice president, that he would be very active moving forward in campaigning for Biden. And I think this response to what's happening right now should be viewed, at least in part, through the eyes of November 2020. He certainly wants Trump removed from the White House, in part because he believes that Trump is poorly equipped to deal with America's issues, including this current one. And he wanted to encourage and mobilize those individuals who have taken to the streets to protest racism and police violence, to also move into voting booths so that they can support Joe Biden with the hope of having some type of leadership and direction down another path than where we're currently going.
And Daniel, Obama also laid out a few policy proposals, especially related to law enforcement. What were they?
Yeah, one thing that I thought was really interesting was that he didn't really get into politics too much. I think Obama, as so many people look up to him, framed this very much about local issues, saying that it's important for for people. You know, the protests are ephemeral, that they'll come and go. But he wanted to push for real lasting change and said that people should get involved in local issues and state and local elections. And that would be the real thing that would affect change regarding police forces, because they are, of course, controlled by state and local politicians. And I thought that it was interesting that he and his predecessor, George W. Bush, in his separate statement, didn't really call out Trump, but more so laid an example that stands in contrast to how President Trump is handling the current protests.
Attorney General Bill Barr said yesterday he has evidence Antifa and far-right extremist groups have hijacked peaceful protests. Anita, do we know what evidence he has?
You know, they haven't really gone into detail. A couple things that have been said are that police around the country, I know in New York and other cities, saw you know, piles or trash cans or containers full of, you know, things that could be thrown or used, like pieces of concrete that could be used. And that's apparently a sign when you see that someone is coming around and organizing, particularly if it's in different cities. But, you know, the Department of Justice is going to look into this, whether this is organized. But this is something we've seen the Trump administration saying for the last week or so, that this is, you know, some of these protests have been organized. They're outsiders, you know, but when you look at who some of these people that have been arrested for some of the, you know, charges, looting and vandalism, it's actually local people. So it's a little bit unclear what they're talking about and what that proof is. I was really struck. The president and Bill Barr and some others had a call with the 50 governors this week, and that audio leaked out, and I listened to that. And one of the things that the governor of Maine really pushed on is she asked, where is this evidence? This would be so helpful to us in Maine and other states, of course, to get that information. And they didn't answer that. You know, Bill Barr wasn't able to or didn't feel that he wanted to provide that information. And they said, well, we'll get back to you. So we haven't really seen that proof they're talking about.
A number of listeners want to go back to that photo op in front of the church. Christina emails, I attend a conservative church in Washington, D.C. All the fellow Christians I know are outraged that the president would clear protesters to hold up a Bible. His actions and belief clearly are antithetical to everything Jesus teaches in the book he held. And we received an email from a listener asking to comment on how there are some evangelicals like Pat Robertson who have chastised Trump for the way he's responded to the protest. Eugene, do you think that might move the needle in terms of what Trump does?
That is certainly worth mentioning. We also saw, you know, Michael Ware, who is a former evangelical in the Obama administration, speak out against the action. But we know that we've seen conservative Christians speak out against bits and pieces and individual actions coming from the president and ultimately get right back on the MAGA train before the end of the week or eventually, because when they compare things to their Democratic rival, ultimately they do back the GOP candidate.
Yeah. Still to come, we're going to talk about Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's decision not to do anything about President Trump's inflammatory posts. We'll hear more from our guests and from you in a moment. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Cell phone footage shows police killing unarmed Black people. Protesters take to the streets, rinse and repeat for a decade. Why?
Everyone moves on.
A blunt reminder that we've been here before on Code Switch from NPR.
This is 1A. We're talking with Eugene Scott. He's a political reporter with the Washington Post. Anita Kumar is White House correspondent and associate editor with Politico. And Daniel Neuhauser, a freelance journalist, former senior political reporter at Vice News. We did get a tweet from More Truth, who says, as a black man, I'll just be so glad when most of the white population can sincerely cry about the issues that I face each and every day. So, Eugene, the Department of Justice has authorized the Drug Enforcement Agency to conduct temporary surveillance of demonstrators. And I wonder if you would walk us through this. Is this an expansion of law enforcement powers while people are protesting against those very powers?
It certainly appears to be, and there's a great concern among Americans who are focused on privacy issues about this decision. This is in part motivated by the Justice Department and the Trump White House's belief that many of the demonstrators are actually Antifa and other members of left-leaning groups and movements focused on perhaps dismantling some government agencies and efforts, adding to violence and property damage, and causing more harm that could be a greater public safety issue. But there hasn't been a lot of proof provided publicly, at least, showing why this is necessary. And some are even questioning the legality of it because of that.
It's important to remember that through all of this, there were some primaries this past week. And Daniel, I wonder if you could walk us through some of the notable winners and losers in these primaries.
Well, at a time when people are out in the streets protesting against racism, it's very interesting that the most notable accused racist in Congress has lost his reelection bid. Steve King, the Iowa Republican, who has so angered even his own Republican colleagues that he was stripped from all committee assignments, lost a primary against a local businessman. So he will no longer be in Congress. Now, on the other side of that coin, I would say that the loser in that race might actually be the Democrat running. J.D. Scholten almost beat King last cycle. It was so close. It came right down to the wire. And I was actually out there in Iowa last year with Scholten as he was trying to kind of relight that fire. I mean, this guy is kind of like a rock star among local Democrats. Every room he walks into, people saying, go and get King. You know, they wear shirts that say, Dear America, we're sorry about Steve King. Well, now J.D. Scholten doesn't have King to run against anymore. He's got a sort of a milquetoast everyday Republican. And you've got to wonder whether that's really going to dampen his case for being able to be elected as a Democrat in what still is a pretty conservative-leaning district.
We also saw Ferguson get its very first African-American mayor, a African-American woman as well. So there were some notable moments. But I wonder, you know, a number of celebrities have participated in protests. They've contributed to bail funds for protesters who've been arrested. There's the Minnesota Freedom Fund. That is a small Minneapolis fund that raised around $20 million this week. And I wonder, Anita, can you give us sort of an idea of what significant people, what celebrities have stepped forward and what they've done?
Yeah, you mentioned raising money, and you mentioned also they're just involved in the protests. You've seen them some come out to protests in California and New York and other places, and you've seen them just issue statements. And sometimes, you know, we think, oh, well, just a statement. Some of these people haven't really participated before. They haven't been out there talking, so that's notable even when they're giving a statement. I'll name just a couple, but there's actually been so many in Hollywood and in the sports world, but Michael Jordan is one that people have said, you know, hasn't participated in the past really, but came out with a really forceful statement. You know, people have thought, well, hey, he's not going to comment, or he hasn't commented, he hasn't gotten involved, because he was worried about, you know, selling products and all that
stuff. Nike. Let me read a little bit from Jordan's statement. He said, quote, I am deeply saddened, truly pained, and plain angry. I see and feel everyone's pain, outrage, and frustration. I stand with those who are calling out the ingrained racism and violence toward people of color in our country. We have had enough, end quote. So, Eugene, we also heard from Tiger Woods, Jaylen Brown, LeBron James, Derek Jeter, a number of other sports icons. And it has renewed the debate over Colin Kaepernick's choice to take a knee during the national anthem. I wonder if you think this might have an impact eventually on sports policy.
Well, we certainly will see this fall. You know, there's been a lot less cause for athletes to shut up and dribble this week compared to how often athletes protesting police violence in the past had been criticized. And I think that's in part because individuals who perhaps were very critical of Kaepernick in the past are looking at these videos and remembering the story, or at least hearing the story of Breonna Taylor, and saying that something absolutely has to stop, including punishing athletes who speak out on these issues that are affecting the communities in which they come from.
New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees, who is white, was strongly criticized this week. He originally reiterated his stance, his previous stance, that he will, quote, never agree with anybody disrespecting the flag of the United States of America, end quote. He has since apologized. Daniel, why did we get that apology from Drew Brees?
Well, he was called out by his own players, and notably his wide receiver,
I think we lost Daniel there for just a second. Anita, could you finish that response? Why did Drew Brees reverse his decision? He hadn't before.
Well, the blowback. I mean, he just got criticized as Drew was trying to say as we were trying to say, even from other players, he was criticized from everybody. And he said, well, look, I apologize. I wasn't trying to say that, one side or the other here. I support, what is going on. I absolutely am out there doing that. But yeah, I mean, I think what is happening, what we're seeing everywhere, is people that are saying one thing or not supportive are getting criticism like they haven't gotten before.
Let's move to social media, because Twitter has started attaching fact-checking and warning labels on a number of tweets, including those from President Trump. In the social media company's latest move, it took down video tributes to George Floyd tweeted by the Trump campaign Thursday because of a copyright complaint. Eugene, can you explain what happened here?
Well, there was some concern that the footage that was being used by the Trump campaign was inaccurate or borrowed or just didn't fit the requirements and standards that that Twitter wants to start using, particularly for campaigns when disseminating information. And there was, as you can imagine, criticism coming from the right that this reinforce some ideas that perhaps a social media company was unfairly policing conservative organizations and ideas in ways that it wasn't from the left. But there were no efforts, at least, to clarify from the Trump campaign how they could have fixed the video or presented one better that fit whatever it is that Twitter said was a problem.
Daniel, another social media platform took action this week. Snapchat's parent company, Snap, on Wednesday said it will stop promoting Trump's campaign account on its Discover tab. For those who are not familiar with Snapchat, can you explain how significant this decision is?
I think it's pretty significant. I mean, a lot of younger people use Snapchat. It's certainly not as prominent as it once was, but this is a platform that's a strategic priority for the Trump campaign. They're trying to reach younger voters, and certainly younger voters, to the extent that they do vote at a very high rates for Democrats. Now, right away, Trump is firing back, calling Snap's leader a radical leftist, and that's really the trouble here with the social media platforms. You're kind of darned if you do, darned if you don't. If you allow this speech to go through, then you may be out of sync with your values and with the values of a lot of people that work for your company. But if you try to put some limits on the president's accounts, then you'll be decried as a leftist and anger half of the other half of the country. And so it kind of stands to figure that a lot of these social media leaders have been kind of caught in the middle of all this.
Facebook has not taken similar action on the president's post. As many as 600 Facebook employees took part in a virtual protest this week. That was in response to CEO Mark Zuckerberg's decision to not take action against President Trump's comments on the platform. And, you know, Anita, Zuckerberg also spoke with President Trump on the phone. Can you tell us a little bit more about that conversation? Because it didn't seem to change anything about Facebook policy.
No, it didn't. I mean, we just need to take a step back here and realize that Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg has been saying this from the beginning, right? For years now, they have been pressured by people in Washington and elsewhere to really push back, not on just on President Trump, but just to really police things that are on Facebook. And he has adamantly said he's not going to, and nothing has changed this week. But you're starting to see people really, you know, protest that. Obviously, his employees, but also people not using Facebook, getting off Facebook, members of Congress. But what has really changed, I feel like, is that you are seeing Twitter and you are seeing Snap pushing back on the president. And that's why there's even more pressure on Facebook. And as you indicated, in all the calls, he's also had, other conversations with other leaders this week in light of the protests and everything that's going on.
Leaders of civil rights groups, yeah.
Yeah, he has not changed anything. And he does not want to get into that. He says that's not the place for Facebook to sort of police what's going on there.
We got an email from Margaret who says, I'm afraid if Trump is reelected, the outcry and protests will be even worse than what is happening now. But if he loses the election, will he and his base supporters challenge the validity of the elections? There's no way to feel optimistic about the November election. I wanted to just take a moment here, Eugene. There's so many concerns, not just Margaret's over the upcoming election, but what we're seeing right now is truly a significant period in American history happening before our eyes. And I wonder, what is going through your mind this week? What are you thinking about?
I think it's just been really fascinating to me personally how much attention issues that some voters have been discussing for years is now getting. I mean, this week to me just wasn't about George Floyd. It was about the larger issue of police violence, but also combined with this pandemic that's disproportionately killing Black Americans, as well as an economic downturn where we know that people of color are disproportionately losing work. And so all of these individuals have gotten behind these issues and said something is wrong with America as is, and we need leaders, not just one in the White House, but leaders across the board, to move this country in a direction where it works better for multiple people. And so I'm very much left here contemplating what's going to happen next. You know, it wasn't just a one-day protest, obviously, but what is going to happen next? What pressure will be put on government leaders, business leaders, and other individuals who influence our society?
I got to ask you, Eugene, because these are all issues that you have been reporting on and writing about for a very long time. And I just wonder if you are seeing something different this time around that might suggest there will be a different outcome.
To me, it's just the demographics that are at the table. And I know that is a repeat to an earlier answer. But that for me, I mean, I was working from home one day covering this issue and looking out my window, watching protesters walk by. And I'll tell you, in that particular march, more than 50% of the participants were white. And we just have not seen predominantly white protests against anti-Black racism since the Black Lives Matter movement began.
We have been talking with Eugene Scott. He's a political reporter with The Washington Post. Anita Kumar is White House correspondent and associate editor with Politico, and Daniel Neuhauser, a freelance journalist and a former senior political reporter at Vice News. Thanks to all of you for making time for us. I should note that the polling on the support for Black Lives Matter has gone up significantly. If you look at the polls, they're changing day by day, but support among the American populace nationwide has gone up dramatically. Remember, you can find us on Instagram. You can follow us at The 1A Show and find us on other social media. 1A's socially distant lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. Stay with us for the international section of our news roundup right after this. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee, and it's time for the international edition of our news roundup. Indonesia, home to more Muslims than anywhere else in the world, has opened its mosques and other places of worship for the first time in 3 months. A court in Australia has refused to grant protesters permission to hold another Black Lives Matter rally in Sydney. And in Vienna, the world-famous Vienna Philharmonic is about to give its first post-lockdown concert. The music? Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Our news roundup performers are Hayes Brown, co-host of the podcast News O'Clock from BuzzFeed. Indira Lakshmanan is senior executive editor at National Geographic and occasional 1A host. And we welcome back Courtney Kuby, national security and military reporter at NBC News. And there is a lot to cover, so you'll forgive me if we dive in. Let us start in Canada, where this week's silence, a lot of silence, spoke volumes.
You've been reluctant to comment on the words and actions of the U.S. president, but we do have Donald Trump now calling for military action against protesters. We saw protesters tear gas yesterday to make way for a presidential photo op. I'd like to ask you what you think about that, and if you don't want to comment, what message do you think you're sending?
Okay, so the silence actually extended longer than that. That was CBC reporter Tom Perry posing a question to the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, from Tuesday. And in the end, Trudeau was speechless for 21 seconds before responding. Hayes, what was the response after? Clearly, it was carefully thought out.
Right, clearly, because Trudeau has been having to walk a tightrope, really, of having to satisfy his own base's concerns about race and about the actions of the U.S. president, while also not angering the United States so badly that it affects international relations. So eventually he got around to responding that, you know, a very generic statement about how the, you know, U.S. should not be using military force against protesters, et cetera, et cetera. But it really does, that silence was really incredible. It's not often you have that long a gap between when you ask a question of a politician when they actually respond. Politicians love to give off-the-cuff answers, no matter how much they actually know about the subject, it seems. So for Trudeau to take that long to gather his thoughts, plus he has his own, you know, complicated history with race in his own country to deal with. So on the one hand, he has an obligation almost to speak out against racism in the form of police brutality. He has an obligation to talk about how these issues in America have affected Black lives down here and up in Canada. But he also has an obligation to the country to make sure that Canada and the United States remain on solid footing.
Indira, I wonder what the response was among Canadians, because as Hayes referred to, during Trudeau's re-election campaign, photos surfaced of Trudeau wearing blackface and brownface. His record on racism is not perfect. To be generous, what was Canadians' response?
Well, Trudeau did eventually say, after that more than 20-second pause, he eventually said, "We all watch in horror and consternation what's going on in the United States," which has been the sentiment phrased in different ways from world leaders everywhere, from places like Iran and China and Russia, which have gloated about it because the United States has, you know, obviously taken a stand over the years on human rights violations and crackdowns on protesters in their countries. And so those nations are now coming back and saying, "You're not so great, are you? Not so high and mighty." And also in many of our close democratic allies, countries like Canada, the UK, France, and elsewhere. I mean, you're right that the blackface and brownface images of him dressed up at a party in something trying to be, it seemed like, Aladdin, you know, were very unfortunate and embarrassing for him and for his party. At the same time, the response that he gave at the time was that his cabinet was the most racially and ethnically diverse in the history of Canada. So, you know, he has told his people, I'm putting my money where my mouth is by actually appointing people of color into positions, high positions in government, so that I have the voices that I need. I think his response has been that, you know, he's getting the right people in those positions, even if he, as a white man, may not have the perspective that needs to be heard from those folks.
And Ron writes this to us: Trudeau's 21 seconds of silence speaks to a larger story. He most likely wanted to give a scathing review of Trump, but as the leader of a nation, he withheld his personal thoughts and instead thought of Canada. This was a courageous decision. And Bryn points out, not to be that guy, but this man wore brown face in the 2000s. He's obviously a few steps above Trump, but we're setting the bar pretty low. There have been a number of discussions about this around the world, and protests in support of the Black Lives Matter movement in Hong Kong, in the UK, in Brazil, and elsewhere. Tens of thousands have gathered to protest the death of George Floyd. Here's what one demonstration sounded like in London. Protesters were gathered outside the American embassy. So, Courtney, what is the, I mean, these many displays around the world, what exactly are the worldwide protests hoping to achieve?
I mean, the majority of them are organized in support of Black Lives Matter. But the one thing that I have found really fascinating about them is that while each one is, they talk about Black Lives Matter, they're supporting it, they're supporting, you know, the protests in the United States, they're condemning the murder of George Floyd. The one thing I found fascinating is that each one also has a local element to it. So in France, we saw about 20,000 protesters take to the street in Paris on Tuesday. And they were, of course, they were talking about George Floyd, but they were also protesting the July 2016 death of a French man originally from Mali who died in police custody several hours after being taken into custody. His family, they got a private autopsy that found that he died from asphyxiation, but no police officers were ever charged in his death. The same thing in England, you mentioned, Celeste. There were thousands who protested in London, and actually, I mean, interestingly enough, the chief constables, which the best I can understand it is sort of like a group of the senior police officers in the country, they actually put out a statement say that they stood appalled and horrified by the death of George Floyd. But in London, they were protesting a woman named Beli Muhinga, who was a railway worker who died from coronavirus. And there was a belief that she was spit on by a white man who said that he had coronavirus, she contracted it and died. There's later less belief that she actually died, that her death was directly related to that attack. But that's the one thing that I found so fascinating is that in all of these protests around the world, it's not just that they're saying there's a situation in the United States and the world needs to recognize it. They're saying, look, we also have a problem here. It is uniting the world right now in the fact that they recognize that racial inequality exists everywhere.
And let's go a little further into that situation in France. Again, nearly 20,000 people were gathered to protest the death of a black man who was in custody in tragically similar circumstances to George Floyd. That was a 24-year-old French man, Adama Traoré, who was killed by police in 2016. Hayes, can you tell us a little bit about that case and how it has sparked the protests in France?
Yeah, for sure. So back in 2016, Traoré was, there was a dispute over his identity and an identity check, and he was apprehended after leading the police on a chase. So one of the arresting officers has told investigators that they pinned him down with their combined body weight. He lost consciousness while they were transporting him and died in a nearby police station. Apparently, he was still handcuffed when the paramedics arrived. And that situation there, recently were new medical reports sent out saying that his death was caused by, on the one hand, they're saying it was positional suffocation, which is saying that it was because of how he was positioned. On the other hand, some are saying that it was heart failure brought on by underlying health conditions. And in a weird way, that really mirrors the competing medical examiner reports that we got for George Floyd this week.
Yeah.
On the one hand, medical examiner for the state saying that, oh, it was because of underlying health conditions, he had a heart condition, et cetera. But a private autopsy done by the family saying, no, he died of, you know, he was suffocated. He died because of the way that former officer's knee was held on his neck.
Indira, can you take a minute and just tell us what these global protests tell us about how America is seen worldwide?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the point that Courtney made, that a lot of countries are looking inwardly, or at least France and England are looking inwardly, that may be so. But I also think that there's no doubt that the problem, the scale of the problem in the United States, is at a different level. And all you have to do is think about, you know, there are a few British and French names that we can think of. Certainly, the problem is there. Absolutely. And, you know, in France, a spokesperson said, oh, we're not a racist country. Of course, every country wants to believe that.
Yeah.
But in the United States, we have an incredibly long list, you know,
yeah.
and it's not just George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Philando Castile, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Trayvon Martin. The list goes on and on of Black people who have been killed, you know, through police actions.
Yeah.
And I think that what we're seeing around the world is a lot of countries like Italy, allies,
yeah.
Africa, all over, worried, what does this mean about America, a country that they look up to as a democracy?
Let's move to Australia, because Prime Minister Scott Morrison urged citizens there not to attend Black Lives Matter protests because of COVID-19.
I think all Australians owe all those other Australians a great duty of responsibility. And I say to them, don't go. Not because you shouldn't express your view, find another way to express your view. We all found a way on Anzac Day to thank those who gave us our liberty and not gather in large numbers. And we stood on the end of our driveways and we held up a light on that dawn in our windows or in our balconies, and we found a way to celebrate those who gave us our liberty. Let's not misuse that liberty.
So, Courtney, protesters in France were also defying a ban put in place by the government because of COVID-19 when they gathered for rallies. What do you make of this balance between protest and the urge to protect people's health?
Yeah, and actually in England, authorities also urged people not to gather for the same reason. They're worried about the spread of coronavirus. I mean, look, I can say every place is going to be different, but I spent yesterday down in Lafayette Square and Lafayette Park, and one thing that I was really struck by was how I didn't see a single protester. I was there for almost 8 hours. I didn't see a single protester who didn't have a mask on. Now, people are close together, so it is a fair concern that this is going to lead to another spread of coronavirus. But the one thing that I've also found striking is the places that are urging people not to protest because of the concern about coronavirus, they're not offering an alternative. So what would the alternative be? We have these people. I mean, the protests that I saw in D.C. yesterday afternoon and evening, they were peaceful. They were people. They were yelling. They were angry. There's no doubt about that. But we didn't. There wasn't the violence. There wasn't the looting. These people need to get their message out. So, I mean, I would just ask these leaders who say the protesters who I saw were being as responsible as they could be with thousands of people together in one place. They were outdoors. But I would just ask these leaders who are calling on them not to gather, what alternative are they offering for these people to get their message out?
Moving to Rome, on Wednesday, Pope Francis condemned the death of George Floyd. It was a televised address, and the Pope said, quote, "We cannot tolerate or turn a blind eye to racism and exclusion in any form. End quote. He added, "We have to recognize that violence of recent nights is self-destructive and self-defeating." Again, end quote. So, Hayes, Vatican analysts have pointed out it is very rare for a pope to mention a specific person by name. How significant do you think this address is?
I think it's fairly significant. And the fact that this is such a clear case of police brutality that it's been impossible for many people who would normally brush it aside to say otherwise. And I think the fact that the papacy is giving its imprimatur to calling out this level of brutality is a big deal. Because for all of the Catholic Church's past, you know, acquiescences to the sins of racism, including, you know, slavery throughout the years, the fact that he is now calling on the millions upon millions of Catholics around the world to take this to heart is a big deal to me, especially considering the fact that it's something that we've seen trickle down as well throughout the Catholic ranks. I wanted to bring up the fact that earlier this week, President Trump in the U.S., he made an appearance at a shrine honoring Pope John Paul II, and the Washington Archbishop Wilton Gregory, he condemned Trump for that visit. He said that it was baffling and reprehensible that the president would show up the day after after using tear gas to disperse peaceful protesters outside the White House. Yeah. So it's really something that Francis is using this time to push that message forward.
Well, as you mentioned, Indira, the protests going on here did not pass without comment in China. The Chinese state news agency described what we've seen here as, quote, Pelosi's beautiful landscape. Seemingly, that's a reference to Speaker Pelosi's comment last summer that the Hong Kong protests were, in her words, quote, a beautiful sight to behold. Indira, is it just me, or is the antagonism between the Washington and Beijing getting worse as each week comes and goes?
I mean, look, Celeste, I was based in China for 7 years, and the number of times that I wrote the story that U.S.-China relations are reaching a new level of antagonism, I mean, there are so many example points
you
can use for that.
Copy-paste on your computer at this point?
Yes, there's no room left, but I mean, I would say they are looking at this as, you know, that the United States is getting its own back. As I said earlier, there are a lot of authoritarian countries out there, China, Russia, Iran, to name three, who are, you know, celebrating in a way that the United States is having such problems now. And they are pointing a finger saying we shouldn't be the ones. People who live in glass houses shouldn't be casting stones at them. There are also, you know, leaders in more nascent democracies or more troubled countries like Iraq. I found it really interesting that a whole conversation was going on in Iraq with people comparing President Trump holding the Bible outside St. John's Church to the photo, the famous one of Saddam Hussein holding up a Quran at his trial, when he was well known, Saddam Hussein, to not be a religious person at all, and, you know, held it up as a way to try to show his loyalty to Islam. The trial obviously did not end well for him. He was executed. But it unfortunately puts the United States on really bad footing after criticizing countries around the world, including criticizing Hong Kong authorities and Chinese authorities for cracking down on protesters there, for us then to be perceived as cracking down on protesters here. So it's a very difficult position for the United States to be in. But on the point of U.S.-Chinese relations, yes, it is yet another low point in our relationship. And one of those things was over this whole dispute over air travel between the U.S. and China.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, Courtney, because Wednesday, the U.S. Department of Transportation announced Chinese passenger airlines will be banned from flying to the U.S. beginning June 16th. Why?
So this came after Beijing announced that they were limiting flights to the U.S. They attributed that to coronavirus, the ongoing pandemic. So Beijing announced that, then the U.S. said, well, we're also going to ban passenger flights. And then Beijing said, well, okay, well, we'll ease some of our restrictions. And then the U.S. said, okay, well, we'll ease ours as well, and we'll allow one flight per week, and the airline carrier can fly to the city of their choice. It begins, I think, June 8th next week. So it's just interesting because it's this odd brinksmanship of back and forth about commercial airline flights, you know. But I completely agree with Indira. I feel like, you know, whether it's the trade war or the South China Sea or now coronavirus and the Wuhan lab and how, you know, what did China know early on? What did they hide? And how many people in the world may have died because of it? It just seems like every time we have another milestone in the tensions or the bad relationship between the U.S. and China, we just hit another one. And I don't think that's over, because at some point we are going to learn more and more about, you know, exactly what China did know and some of the early on about the coronavirus. That I think the Trump administration will take advantage of and use, and we will see yet another low point in the relations between the two countries.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Hong Kong. Thousands defied a police ban in Hong Kong to mark the 31st anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, and that played out hours after the territory's legislature passed a law that makes mocking the Chinese national anthem a criminal offense. Hayes, we talked a little bit last week on the Roundup about the U.S. decision to stop treating Hong Kong as an autonomous country. I wondered if you could bring us up to date on what is not only happening with Hong Kong, but our nation's relationship with them, and whether or not we could see some more statements coming out of the State Department.
I mean, we could, but here's the thing. The U.S. has lost a lot of ground in terms of being able to make a difference on Hong Kong, I feel like. The current state is that, you know, you had this week Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with survivors of the Tiananmen Square massacre and highlighted the brutality against Hong Kong protesters. You have in the U.S. Senator Tom Cotton trying to push for the U.S. to accept refugees from Hong Kong on the grounds of political persecution. But at the same time, as they're pushing this and they're, as Indira was saying, pushing this narrative about how the Chinese government is brutal, it's repressive, etc., we're seeing the president and the rest of his administration pushing for stronger crackdowns from the police in a way that it just really doesn't quite add up. So we could be seeing more statements and more bills put forward in Congress to support Hong Kong, et cetera. You could see a disruption in trade status for Hong Kong, but it just doesn't seem like those actions will have the desired effect, which is to say, making China back down from its basically takeover and imposition of Beijing's direct rule on Hong Kong.
Well, let's look at the way other countries have reacted, shall we? Starting with the UK. In 1997, the UK gave Hong Kong back to the Chinese. This week, it said it will offer 3 million Hong Kong residents a pathway to British citizenship. Here is British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab speaking in the House of Commons on Tuesday.
Even at this stage, I sincerely hope China will reconsider its approach. But if not, the UK will not just look the other way when it comes to the people of Hong Kong. We will stand by them, we will live up to our responsibilities, and I commend this statement to the House.
Indira, why do you think the UK is taking this particular move?
This is a really big deal, and many would say it's long overdue. I actually was living in Hong Kong in 1997 and covered the handover from Britain to China. And this is a story that has much deeper roots than any one protest. I mean, let's not forget that it was 1984 under Margaret Thatcher, you know, a completely different government, that Britain actually made an agreement with China that it would return this longtime colony. And it's not as if Britain really had a choice, in a sense. I mean, Britain had invaded China during the First Opium War and seized Hong Kong. It was going to have to give it back. The agreement was that starting in 1997, 15 years after this decision was made, that Hong Kong would get a return to China under a 50-year agreement of one country, two systems. So a guarantee that the capitalist system would extend for 50 years. We're halfway through that agreement now. And the promise that was made at the time of one country, two systems, you know, people, reporters, analysts, academics were worried about it, and certainly pro-democracy activists were worried about it on the eve of the handover in 1997, and their concerns have turned out to be valid over the years, as we see it. First, China very much maintained Hong Kong as allowing them to do their own thing. Over the years, people had hoped that there would be more and more democratic reforms, direct voting. None of that ever happened. And what has really brought this to a head is this fight over this new national security law, which, if passed, would essentially end that one country, two systems, in that Hong Kong citizens would be treated just like Chinese citizens. So what Britain is doing now, very belatedly, some would say, you know, 30 to 40 years overdue, is saying that those Hong Kongers who are eligible for British national overseas passports, which is something like 3 million people, would be given a path to citizenship and the ability to live in the UK if that national security law is passed. So it's a very big deal. It's something that did not happen under previous British leaders. Yeah. If this national security bill goes through, it'll be interesting to see if Britain actually follows up. It could also be a threat to China, trying to draw a line in the sand.
So a few weeks ago, in this interesting story, an Indian engineer called Sonam Wangchuk posted this message on YouTube encouraging everyone to do this.
Boycott made in China, software in a week and hardware in a year. क्योंकि साजो सामान के लिए वक्त लगेगा हमारे अपने देश से और बाहर से विकल्प निकलने तक तो उसे हम एक.
You can get his point. He started out right at the top saying boycott made in China. This week, Google made the decision to take down that engineer's Android service that made it very easy for folks to delete apps made in China. It was the Remove China apps. It had been downloaded more than 1 million times in the first 10 days after its launch. It was hugely popular in India. Of course, in India, tensions with China are very high over a disputed border in the Himalayas. And I wonder, Courtney, what is the story here between this app and what does it reflect in the relationship between these two countries?
So it was supposed to help Indians identify apps that were made by Chinese developers with the idea, as you mentioned, of them ultimately boycotting Chinese software. It wasn't perfect. It had some pretty good ratings, but there were also users who were saying it missed, you know, this and this and this, all these various apps that actually were developed in China. So, but, you know, as you mentioned, it was then abruptly taken down after being downloaded several million times. And apparently it was because it violated some policy that apps cannot discourage or incentivize users to remove other apps. But you know, it comes at what I found interesting about this story was just the number of people in India who felt so strongly about this, about, yeah, you know, distancing themselves from Chinese software that they downloaded it so quickly with the hope of being, right, able to use it. And, you know, the tensions have been high even just in the past several days. There's been this ongoing border dispute that yeah, you mentioned, Celeste. It's for decades now, right? The tensions in this very remote area of the Himalayas where there's a dispute over where the border actually stands. But
right,
it's just been flaring up in the past several days. Beijing has made a couple of aggressive moves.
Yeah.
The people I'm talking to, the national security experts and foreign policy experts, don't believe this is actually going to flare into a conflict.
Yeah.
There haven't been any shots fired since like 1970s. But it does come at an interesting time, and it's not just India's not in a vacuum here.
Yeah.
There is an increasing reluctance to have this overwhelming use of Chinese software,
right,
and it's a big dispute the U.S. is having with European allies, yeah, right now about, you know, 5G networks.
Indira, we got a tweet from a listener that sounds like it's in response to what you have been saying. And so I wanted to give you the chance to respond to Elle Marie, who tweets this. One of your panelists suggested that America was somehow exceptional when discussing the scale of racist policing in this country versus places like England and France. Racism rooted in white supremacy is a feature of all Western countries, especially those with violent histories of slavery and colonialism. It's disrespectful to the anti-racist activists in those countries to minimize what they're fighting against. In each country, activists can name plenty of black and brown people who have been brutalized by racist police. What's your response?
Well, obviously, I was not being disrespectful to activists anywhere. It's absolutely true that every country that has a slavery history or a colonial history or other forms of oppression, systemic oppression of people of a certain race or ethnicity, have the problem that we're discussing here. It's also a fact that the United States is a bigger country by population, and that we have a slavery history that is beyond those of other nations in terms of its scale and the years of how long it lasted. So it's certainly not to minimize that people in the UK and France and Australia and elsewhere have every right to be protesting about systemic racism in their countries. No one would deny that. It's also true that in the United States, the number, the absolute number, and the scale is just frankly bigger because of our history and because of the size of our country.
Okay, so Thursday, we got a completely different story. U.S. Navy veteran Michael White had been detained in Iran for more than a year, and he was released by the authorities in Tehran. His mom, Joanne White, confirmed in a statement he had been freed, saying the nightmare is over. Courtney, do we know if a deal was done to make this happen?
All evidence points that there was some sort of a prisoner exchange here, but you know, officially, the government is not saying that. The U.S. government is not saying that. But just look at the facts, you know. So Michael White was arrested in July of 2018 while he was visiting an Iranian woman in Mashhad. He was convicted of insulting the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini and sentenced to 10 years. But the reality is he was sent to prison because Iran believed he was a spy. And he also is caught up, as others have been and continue to be, in the ongoing, you know, both sides, U.S. and Iran, accusing one another of holding their citizens for political reasons. But the big concern about Michael White was that he's a throat cancer patient. He's been in declining health. And we now know there was some concern, but we now know for a fact that he did have coronavirus while he was in prison. So he was furloughed and let out a few weeks ago. But this does appear to be part of some sort of a prisoner exchange, because as he was flying out of Iran, there were prosecutors who were arranging for the release of an Iranian-American doctor who was convicted in 2018 in the United States of some sort of a violating some sort of an exports clause. And not just him, it was like about a day or two after an Iranian scientist who'd been held in the United States by immigration authorities for months since late 2019 was sent back to Iran and arrived back in Iran. So, you know, it could all be a coincidence, but the reality is, you know, officials who we're talking to are pointing us in the direction that there was a prisoner exchange. And this is the timing for this is terrific for President Trump. You know, it's a welcome diversion from everything that we've been talking about, the ongoing domestic turmoil with coronavirus and the protests.
Well, let's talk about coronavirus, because the pandemic continues, and it's still really affecting large parts of the world. The global death toll is approaching 400,000. Hayes, is there some kind of snapshot you can provide to give us an update on where we are in the global fight against COVID-19?
Sure. Things are still bad. I will put that out there. I will say that thankfully the United States has become less of an epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic, thanks to mostly declining numbers in the New York City region. You've seen multiple days of zero death in several big cities in the United States, which is great. But unfortunately, Latin America is getting hit harder and harder by it. And nowhere is that more true than in Brazil, which has now become the country with the third highest number of cases in the world. And so while we have that going on, there are still several countries who are scrambling to try and find either, if not a vaccine, then a way to treat the coronavirus. And I have to say, I found it weirdly encouraging that for once in my lifetime, a attempt to get international funding in a conference worked out better than expected in the UK. They wanted to raise money at a conference, a global vaccine summit hosted by the United Kingdom. And in the end, they raised almost £7 billion, which is more than they were expecting.
Yeah, let's give a few more details about this. So on Thursday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson hosted the virtual global vaccine summit, as you mentioned. It was attended by business and government leaders from more than 50 countries, raised $8.8 billion. Indira, how is this money going to be used?
Well, this was raised, the Vaccines Alliance, Gavi, which is supported by the Gates Foundation, is mainly intending this $8.8 billion to vaccinate 300 million children in dozens of countries against existing diseases like malaria, pneumonia, and HPV. They are also talking about an advanced market commitment mechanism, which would enable developing countries to get any effective COVID-19 vaccine whenever it becomes available. And for that, they're trying to raise an additional $2 billion. Obviously, there was a lot more attention on this summit this year because of COVID than in general. And there was a lot of talk about how do you deal with the equity issue of, you know, first world countries like the United States and Britain being at the forefront of the development of a potential vaccine versus poorer countries who will are not necessarily the ones developing it, but to make sure that the vaccine is given out equitably. And that's something that the leaders have been talking about. But I wanted to say that, you know, in terms of the numbers, we're talking about 6.5 million people infected worldwide. As Hayes said, nearly 400,000 people dead. These are the figures that we know, according to the World Health Organization and nations collecting their own figures. There's no doubt that the figures are more than that, particularly in countries that either for political reasons are hiding their numbers or countries that are just simply not capable of tracking every single death. And people may be, you know, dying in slums or in large areas where there's close contact of people and low access to hand washing and hygiene, that those are uncountable numbers. I mean, the breaking news this morning on the WHO website is that Brazil is actually now in second place after the United States with almost 600,000 confirmed cases. The U.S. is still the highest with 1.8 million cases. So it's extremely worrisome because as we've seen throughout the world, people are eager to get back to normal life and are in various ways, you know, breaking the lockdown, loosening the lockdown. But that doesn't mean that this disease is going to cooperate with our desire to go back to normal life. And, you know, a lot of doctors and epidemiologists are talking about possible second waves. Anthony Fauci here in the United States at the NIH, you know, said in an interview with us at National Geographic that it's going to take 18 months probably for a vaccine, although he's hoping something might be possible in January. So we have a long road ahead.
And I want to be clear that every time we talk about these statistics as incredible numbers, they always represent real people. And I know that you have had a personal loss of your own, and dear, I wanted to extend the condolences of the entire team here on the loss of your mother. And I just wondered if you would take a moment to tell us about her.
Thank you, Celeste. That's really kind. Yes, my mother died this week of coronavirus, of COVID. And, you know, the whole experience has been heartbreaking because my mother was living in a nursing home, and so I had not been able to see her in person since early March because of the lockdown at her nursing home. I was fortunate enough that the hospital here in Washington allowed me to visit her because she was in critical condition once she came in last week, and I feel very grateful for that, and they gave me full PPE. I wish that more hospitals would allow people to be with their loved ones in coronavirus. This death, you know, it's terrible to lose a parent at any time. It happens that a month ago I had just published a story about my mom in National Geographic as part of our big package. Our June issue is dedicated to the last voices of World War II. And my mother, who was actually born and raised in Poland, her name was Teresa Romanowska, Lakshmanan. She was only 8 years old when World War II began. She was a victim of the Nazis. She miraculously escaped from a Nazi camp. She and her mother were being shipped to an extermination camp, and they managed to jump off a train. Wow. But her family was destroyed. Her father and her brother were taken to slave labor camps in Germany. And I wrote a month ago about her indomitable will and her just incredible survivor spirit that imbued every aspect of her life, surviving the Nazis, surviving the Soviets in the years afterwards when Poland was under, you know, Soviet influence and occupation. And, you know, then coming to this country in the 1960s and the life that she made for herself here, to me, she was really a hero. And so many of these people who lived through World War II, these last voices who we wanted to honor with our special issue, are people who really have lived through incredibly hard times. And to now lose someone who survived all of those things, plus two bouts of cancer, plus a stroke, to lose her to coronavirus, just feels like a really painful reminder of how deadly this disease is.
We're very, really sorry for your loss. And we thank you for coming and talking with us at the news at a time that has to be painful. And I wanted to talk a little bit about a vaccine, which we've mentioned a bit, but it is a global race at this point, and it may have moved forward in Russia this week, perhaps. The health ministry in Russia gave approval to ship a drug that's called Avifavir to the country's hospitals. Hayes, can you tell us what this is and if we know how well it works?
Yeah, so the answer is no, we don't really know how well it works yet. So it's an antiviral drug that is based off of another antiviral drug that it was developed in Japan by Fujifilm, of all companies, because it was moving into healthcare at the time. So Russia has tweaked this drug, they say. They haven't given any details on exactly what those tweaks are, but have approved it for use to, if not vaccinate against the coronavirus, at least treat its symptoms. It's in that sense a little similar to the drug that in the United States that Gilead, the biotech company, is pushing called remdesivir. I probably completely butchered that pronunciation.
Remdesivir, yep.
Thank you. So we don't really know yet how well it works yet. There haven't been any publicized that I've seen studies or clinical trials on how well this relieves COVID-19 symptoms. But if it does work, that would be a big step, because part of the reason why this disease has been so baffling is because of its, once you have it, doctors can tell you that you have it at this point, but they don't really have an effective way to treat it other than how they would treat, say, maybe a flu or a cold, which is to say bed rest and fluids and at times ventilators throughout the progression of the symptoms. So if the Russians have put together a drug that will work, it will be a huge step forward for their country at least. And if it works, then Japan is also working on similar tweaks to that base drug. So if that works out, we will see in theory, at least, a new way of alleviating the symptoms of the people who have contracted it.
Courtney, we only have about a minute left, but what does progress look like worldwide on the treatment for a vaccine? And Indira mentioned the timeline, the suggested timeline here in the U.S. Is that different worldwide?
No, I mean, you know, it's funny. I think everyone looks to Anthony Fauci on this as the voice of reason. Yeah. You know, and as probably the most likely, the one who's going to know when we're going to actually see a vaccine that can be distributed, that can be manufactured and distributed and really help people. But, you know, I cover the military, I cover the Pentagon, and what I've been struck by is how the military seems very confident that they're going to get something in less than 18 months. I mean, they're talking about, you know, 6 to 12 months of having a vaccine. And I think it's very clear that President Trump, or if, you know, depending on who's elected in November, would use the military for distribution of it here in the United States. I can't stress enough what Hayes was saying about this this treatment in Russia. It would by no means would it have flown here in the United States. They tested it on 330 people. I mean, can you imagine a test that size actually being distributed
deployed
to thousands of people?
Yeah, if not millions.
Yeah, and they think they're going to manufacture and give it to 60,000 people per month. And with the way that Russia has been so not at all transparent about their numbers, about the number of deaths and whatnot, I think we should really be skeptical that they've come up with a treatment for that.
That is NBC News' Courtney Kuby. Hayes Brown is co-host of the podcast News O'Clock from BuzzFeed, and Indira Lakshmanan is senior executive editor at National Geographic. Wonderful people who joined us again at a distance for this hour. 1A senior producers are Danielle Knight and Paige Osborne. I Zoom with them from my home studio. Our sound engineer and designer Jake Cherry is my other Zoom pal. Matthew Simonson produces our podcast and probably is still in bed at home in Denver. This program comes to you from my house and from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Celeste Headlee. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.